A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll look ahead to the coming year in opera with a focus on Opera Philadelphia's 017 Festival. I'll speak with Mark Skorka, President and CEO of Opera America, about what the opera world is watching for from this 10-day festival. I'll also interview composer Lembit Beecher, whose opera I Have No Stories to Tell You is among the Philadelphia productions being staged in a non-traditional venue. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Performing arts organizations in Houston continue to take slow steps to recovery in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. The Houston Symphony has said about a dozen of its musicians and staff members suffered damage to their homes. The orchestra has moved its first three concerts of the season from Jones Hall to Rice University's Shepherd School of Music next weekend and is opening them up to the public for free. Houston Grand Opera said in a statement that its performance space at Wortham Hall in the theater district faced more damage than previously thought. The opera still plans to move ahead with its performances next month and is seeking out alternative venues. Houston Ballet has moved its opening performances later this month to the Hobby Center for the Performing Arts. According to the Houston Chronicle, more than 270 million gallons of water flooded the underground parking garages of the theater district, and while 85% had been pumped out by earlier this week, additional salvage work and mold removal will take another few weeks. The Wortham Theater's basement flooded during the storm, and the building remains without power. Also in the news from Texas, the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, whose music director will leave at the end of this season to head the New York Philharmonic, announced that it has reached a three-year contract with its musicians. The players will receive no bump in salary in the current year, but will see a 2% increase in the following 2 years. The orchestra is celebrating its final season with Jaap van Zweden this year before he heads to New York. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. The curtain goes up on new musical seasons across the country this month, and we'll spend the next few weeks hearing about what some orchestras and opera companies have in store. We start this week with Opera Philadelphia, whose 017 Festival debuts September 14th. This 10-day festival will feature seven productions at various venues across the city, including three world premieres. It kicks off with one of those premieres, Elizabeth Cree by composer Kevin Putz and librettist Mark Campbell, as well as a production of War Stories, an operatic pairing of Monteverdi's Il Combattimento di Tancredi e Clorinda, and I Have No Stories to Tell You by composer Lembit Beecher and librettist Hannah Moscovich. Another of the premieres is We Shall Not Be Moved by composer Daniel Bernard Rumain and librettist Mark Bamuthi Joseph, which tells the story of the 1985 standoff between Philadelphia police and the MOVE organization, as seen through the eyes of modern-day students. In addition to the sheer quantity of musical happenings, 017 has attracted attention because of its use of unusual venues. War Stories will be performed at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and Wake World by David Hertzberg will be staged at the Barnes Foundation. I chatted earlier this week with Mark Skorka, President and CEO of Opera America, about his thoughts for what makes 017 a new approach to opera festivals and what the overall opera season is looking like across the country.
There are some important premieres coming up, and people certainly want to see how those new works are received by audiences and by critics. I think there is fascination in the structural concept that's being exercised here, where a kind of traditional opera season will be launched with a festival of opera activity, gaining huge local media, national media coverage at the beginning of then a season that unfolds over the course of the year. So it's a hybrid construct that is being tested. I think everyone's going to watch it very carefully. What fascinates me about it is I have never seen an opera company that has done as extensive research as Opera Philadelphia has done. They have engaged innumerable consultants from outside the field to do various layers of research about what local audiences are looking for, what regional and national audiences might be looking for. They have come up with, I think, extremely informed marketing strategies, excellent graphics. Just recently, they have unleashed the best customer service effort I've ever seen at an opera company. So I'm really watching to see whether a significant investment in research yields a plan that works significantly better than the guesswork that has governed much season planning before.
Well, I'm curious, what specifically about that customer service approach caught your attention?
There are several staff members here at Opera America who have, as private citizens, bought tickets to go to Philadelphia for something. Each of them, separately, different days, has received a phone call from a customer service representative from Opera Philadelphia offering assistance with restaurants, hotels, transportation. Never has anyone had a kind of customer service phone call offering assistance before they travel to a company in another city. So it just stopped us in our tracks as we saw that this was a pattern, and then I called Opera Philadelphia, and in fact, this is part of their planning, and they have, David Devan told me, 7 part-time customer service representatives who are making phone calls to out-of-towners, and I think it is brilliant in terms of supporting this year's festival, but equally full of foresight in terms of making people feel that they want to go back.
Opera festivals have been used by a number of companies in the past very successfully. So I was curious about how some of the things you see specific about how this approach might be embraced by some other opera companies, either in whole or in part.
One of the challenges is that, this conversation notwithstanding, you and I both know that coverage of the traditional performing arts in mainstream media has diminished over the years. There's less newspaper coverage, fewer feature articles, fewer interviews on fewer classical radio stations. Festivals get more attention because of the short-term concentrated activity. The fact that one can see 3 or 4 operas in the course of a weekend or a week, that the operas exist in contradistinction to one another, that it is the only time in the 12-month calendar that people can see opera in that community. And that certainly pertains to many of our festivals, whether it's Cincinnati or Des Moines, St. Louis, Santa Fe, Limerick Glass, others. The festivals have a way of attracting more media attention. Critics from outside the community come because they can see multiple operas. Frequently, in the concentration of opera activity, there are some new and unusual opera titles. So that's part of the mystique, if you will, the magic of the opera festival. For our opera companies that just do one opera every other month through the fall, winter, and spring, it's difficult to garner that kind of media attention. So what Opera Philadelphia is doing in part here, and it's not their only goal, is that at the beginning of the season, everyone's just getting back from summer holiday, they are creating a concentration of activity with 6 productions and I don't know how many performances. So the media attention will be riveted on Opera Philadelphia, but it then, as a company, doesn't go away for the next 11 months. It still has productions. And certainly in the course of the festival, people will be paying attention to the entire season. So I think it is a very interesting way to gain media attention at one point in the year for a company that is performing throughout the year.
Well, you alluded to some of the aspects of this festival, and I wanted to kind of circle back to that and first of all, the new works that are being presented and the range, and also in several cases, the unique presentation of them. For example, mm-hmm. The performances in the barns and the museum. What in particular is very striking about that?
They have completely blown up the orthodox theory, several orthodox theories that, you know, it's only opera if it is in the big opera house. They are letting us know, they are affirming, and certainly we've seen this over the last decade, the number of indie opera companies that are performing in new and unusual venues. But they are affirming that opera, which is, you know, in storytelling that is enhanced and intensified through music, can occur in any space that can accommodate people, singers, instruments, and have a reasonable acoustic. They are really just putting aside the orthodoxy about what an opera house or an opera venue looks like. They're also embracing large scale, small scale. They're doing work in partnerships, as you say, with the museum, with other organizations in Philadelphia. They've had for a long while now a kind of core value that Opera Philadelphia is of the community and not above the community. And I think these partnerships from the Kimmel Center to the Academy to the Fringe Festival to the museum, all of that speaks to me about the opera company being of the community and not in any way buying into the orthodoxy that opera only occurs in the opera house.
One of the issues that opera companies have been facing is trying to find stories that are relevant. The premiere of We Shall Not Be Moved truly is of the community. In that sense, is this a good example of that approach?
It is certainly of the community. The story derived from students in schools in Philadelphia that Opera Philadelphia worked with. I think what's really important when an opera company ventures into the realm of telling a community story, I think it's very important that they go to the source for the story. And in this particular instance, they've gone to students for whom the Operation Move story is still very, very present as a traumatic community experience. Yes, I do believe that engaging one's community requires a heightened ability to listen, to show up and be a guest in order to understand and absorb the elements of the story from the point of view of those who own the story. And this is a prime example of how a local story is absolutely locally generated and is authentic in terms of the origin and telling of it.
Well, certainly opera companies have been striving to find new ways to be in touch with their community, with their audience. What are some other examples that you've found nationwide of companies coming up with unique and potentially successful ways of addressing these challenges?
Certainly, I think Houston Grand Opera has been very successful in their HGOCO collaboration with doing works that are derived from local stories of the various and many immigrant communities in Houston. There have been a number of operas that deal with gay and lesbian issues. And, you know, one of the ones that's, you know, the past couple of seasons, As One by Laura Kaminsky, about a transgender character who is portrayed by two singers, a baritone and a mezzo-soprano. That's become one of the most performed works in the last couple of years among American opera companies. This year, Fellow Travelers, the wonderful piece by Gregory Spears that was premiered in Cincinnati a year and a half ago, is going to a number of companies this year, including Lyric Opera of Chicago and then Minnesota Opera as well. So yes, new opera is very much telling the stories that resonate with the world we live in. And I think it's very important for this multimedia art form, which is in that regard intrinsically contemporary, to be a platform for telling contemporary stories. There are various and continued and wonderful efforts. For instance, Dallas Opera just announced another HD transmission to the public park that's right adjacent to the Opera House. I think of Dallas Opera as well in their production this upcoming season of Sunken Garden, which is a piece by Michael van der Am. But they're using 3D technology in the theater, on stage, and just a new approach to opera production. It's the first time we will have seen 3D in the opera house. Any number of new works, important new works, Girls of the Golden West, new John Adams piece, the Metropolitan Opera's Exterminating Angel, Thomas Addis, after rave reviews in London, coming to New York this fall. In Los Angeles, they had a great success a couple of years ago with Dracula, which was the film that used then a new Philip Glass score. And this year they're doing La Belle et la Bête, which is the Cocteau film. And again, it's a new score from Philip Glass. Very, very interesting way to reach new communities. Then, of course, you know, in San Francisco, we've got the Ring Cycle again this year. And there's nothing like a Ring Cycle to fascinate a community, both devotees of the Ring Cycle, lovers of Wagner, and people who are new to opera but are attracted by this extended multi-part opera. It's kind of like Lord of the Rings for the opera stage. So the range is tremendous. New works, famous old works, new technology, films being used. There's a whole gamut of really interesting work going on. There isn't a company I looked at that doesn't have an American opera this year. You know, we're doing our annual conference in St. Louis in June, and there you have Huang Ro's new opera, An American Soldier, but they're also performing Blitzstein's Regina in the same season. Go back to Philadelphia in the wintertime, George Benjamin's Written on Skin, which had a very successful American premiere at the Lincoln Center Festival a couple of years ago. This is a great moment for American opera in terms of new works, creative approaches, as they're doing in Philadelphia, and as you mentioned at the Art Museum, innovative approaches to producing work, new technology, but still some great productions of traditional repertoire.
It does seem that now we are hearing more and more of more works than having much more frequent subsequent performances. I know in the past that's something when I spoke with composers, at least of symphonic works, they said that was always the challenge, was getting the second, third, and fourth performance. How well is the opera community doing in terms of both sharing co-productions that make that possible, but then going beyond that?
With virtually every opera company doing American opera, the chances for extended performance runs of particularly successful works is greater. So we see, you know, a couple of examples. The Revolution of Steve Jobs premiered in Santa Fe this summer, and it's going on to Seattle and San Francisco and to the Indiana School of Music, the University of Indiana, in a multi-company co-production. We also see productions this year across the country, again, of Dead Man Walking. As I mentioned earlier, Fellow Travelers moving from Cincinnati, the As one of the most performed operas of recent years, Silent Night of Kevin Putz, and of course he has a new opera opening at Opera Philadelphia in 2017. So yes, there are titles that are moving around or getting new productions, sometimes smaller productions, so more smaller mid-sized companies can produce them, and we still see multi-company co-productions. What's funny is that the number of companies now doing second and subsequent works of American operas sometimes reduces the number of companies eligible then to co-produce new works because they've already tied up their American repertoire slots with existing American operas. It's a kind of a sign of progress and a challenge that is born of the richness of the American opera repertoire today, that a company wishing to do contemporary work has such a huge choice either to co-produce something new or to do a production of an opera that's already premiered.
That was Mark Skorka, President and CEO of Opera America. Turning back to Philadelphia, I wanted to focus on the two productions being staged at museum settings. I met with Lembit Beecher recently at the Philadelphia Museum of Art for an overview of War Stories. The Monteverdi work will be performed in the medieval stone cloister. Beecher's I Have No Stories to Tell You will be staged in and around the Grand Hall stairwell. The work focuses on a soldier struggling after her return from the Middle East to come to grips with her experiences and communicate with her husband. The paired production was first performed at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I started off by asking Beecher about how that location and the Monteverdi work inspired his own composition.
being in a museum space and seeing the preservation of these moments in time, you know, moments of war and moments of domesticity, made me think a lot about the after effects of war. And since Il Combattimento is this short little beautiful strange battle scene, it's the action of war, it felt like the only right response to that was to write a piece about the lingering effects of those types of moments.
So then tell us how you expanded on that.
The principal characters in Il Combattimento are a Christian knight and a Muslim knight. And the Christian knight doesn't know that the Muslim knight's actually his beloved in disguise. But there's this back and forth, of almost feeling of jousting, a series of sort of conflicts. And in I Have No Stories to Tell You, we decided to take that same idea and put it in a domestic sphere. So I have a husband and wife who are jousting in a way, verbally trying to understand each other, but one of their experiences has been colored by the experience of war, and there's this gap that's opened up between them. I think the other thing that was really important to me and to the librettist Hannah Moscovich as we worked was to think about the aspect of time. The Monteverdi is this very short piece, 20 minutes long, and so my piece couldn't be too much longer than that. I think it ended up being 35 minutes. But in the Monteverdi, what's being depicted is this short moment, this battle scene. And in my piece, we're trying to depict something that has longer implications. So we came up with this structure of sort of telescoping scenes, a scene that's a minute long, then a scene that's 5 minutes long, a scene that's 13 minutes long, and the final scene's 18 minutes long. In which many things repeat, moments of interaction between the husband and wife repeat, and you have a sense of sort of spiraling out of these sort of the passage of days is what we were trying to accomplish through that.
Now, as you said, the companion challenge to that was bringing it into and working it into the museum venue. How did you let that inspire you, and how did that work itself out in the actual production?
Yeah, I think there are the two main aspects, and one is acoustic, and then the other is about sort of about the things, the look of the place, and what the things that are there. It was written originally for a space in the Metropolitan Museum, which is not quite as grand as the Grand Staircase here at the PMA, but it has some of the same sort of stone, sort of a stone-lined space. It was a very quiet space there, a space of reflection. So acoustically, both that space and the PMA have this, you know, very resonant quality. So that certainly affected the way I approached the musical material and tried to find ways of writing music that could blossom in the space. And in terms of the sort of the objects that are in the museum, it was this funny combination of seeing sort of suits of armor next to sort of chests of, you know, very homely objects that started a lot of our thinking about the piece and the relationship of battle to home life. I think the one other thing to mention is that there's a very small electronic aspect to the music. Most of it's acoustic, played by old-style instruments, but in just a couple little spots there are the little electronic, the pre-recorded cues to add a sense, to make use of the space and add a sense of the texture. And one thing that's really neat now, doing a second performance of the piece and taking it to a different space, is finding a way of setting up the speakers, setting up those electronic moments to really take advantage of the acoustic properties, the nooks and crannies of the physical space. Mm. And hopefully it'll create this sense of sort of sound rising from around the audience.
Well, it actually raises an interesting question. Normally, in a traditional opera, when you'd be writing a traditional opera for stage, how much does the composer, do you as a composer, take into account how this will be produced and presented on stage, or usually is that completely left to whoever will be actually doing the staging of it?
I think it's important as a composer to have a clear idea of what you would like, of an imagination of the production, but then be willing to totally let that go. it is a collaborative process, and there are directors and designers and all these people with amazing ideas involved who might take it in a different direction. But unless you start with some idea of how it'll be performed, it doesn't give people much to react to, and it's easy to make mistakes that are hard to deal with later for the director and designers. You know, if you don't leave enough time for transitions to occur or aren't imagining the type of activity going on stage, that can cause real problems.
And turning back to the story, what are, if you could elaborate a bit on some of the themes and the emotions that these characters are dealing with.
I think the biggest theme is this, the theme of identity and what it means to come home and find yourself changed. That's really the central part of the piece, yeah.
Right. But, you've just arrived in the next few weeks, you'll be actually rehearsing. What are some of the challenges you're looking forward to as you start rehearsing, but more importantly, then start moving into this setting?
I think the quality of sound is always something that's foremost in my mind, because that's what I spend a lot of time thinking about as I'm writing the piece, and especially in a non-traditional space like this, in a space that has a very noticeable acoustic, making sure that the audience can hear the text, at least to some degree, that they can hear the details in the music, while still taking advantage of the blossoming sound in the space, is something that is really important for me. You know, when it comes down to the production elements, I just love to sit back and see what the director and the actor and the singers are doing. So my opinions are less strong about those elements.
And what are your thoughts about this being incorporated as part of this initial OAT17 festival project?
Yeah, it's incredibly exciting. There's so much energy around it, and there's so many people coming, and both audience members, but also other performers. It's great to be able to share it, with people working on totally different projects, to share this experience. I think also just creatively, I think opera sometimes feels like it has to do everything in a night. The tradition is 3-hour pieces that covers so much ground. And in this festival, there's space for stranger, more intimate, smaller, more experimental pieces. Mine is certainly a short piece, and it's one idea, one glimpse of, and I think it's quite intense, but it doesn't try to cover a huge amount of ground. But I think in the context of the festival, that feels okay, and I think it feels like a good thing.
That was composer Lembit Beecher, whose work I Have No Stories to Tell You is among the works lined up for this year's inaugural OAT17 Festival by Opera Philadelphia. Next week, we'll hear from David Hertzberg about his new opera, Wake World. More information is available at operaphila.org. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on A Tempo. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.